Hey, this is Eric Lin, and you're listening to the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey, Ilya Friedman. How's it going?
It's going quite well. Hey, it's time for another fine episode of the Cinematography Podcast. Who is on the show today?
We have Eric Lin. Eric Lin is awesome. And he shot a movie called House of Spoils, so you can watch it right now. A very good movie for your spooky season viewing.
Excellent. Excellent. We'll get into that in just a few moments.
And now, Close Focus.
But first up is our Close Focus. What do we have to yak about? What's going on in the industry? What are people talking about in the world of cinematography?
Well, it's a little wonky, and at the same time, I feel like we've gone over pieces of this in the past, but there was a little bit of a kerfuffle over Camera Image, which is the preeminent film festival for cinematography. That it's the only film festival, to my knowledge, in the whole world whose entire focus is cinematography.
There's one other, and it's in Macedonia, and it's called Manicky Brothers. Manicky Brothers. They are actually technically the oldest cinematography festival, but it has been totally dwarfed and overshadowed by Camera Image in recent years. Although I hear there's sort of a resurgence. There's some people who've been talking about trying to make Manicky Brothers a thing again.
I mean, we should just have one in Burbank. Anyway,
you joke, but you're right. We probably should. We probably should have it.
I don't joke.
Yeah.
I want to be able to like sleep in my own bed and drive to this thing.
I think it sounds awesome.
Yeah. So they chose to show Rust, which we have gone over and over and over Rust, and I'm not tired of talking about it. But this is one thing where I feel like it's kind of important because a friend of the show, Rachel Morrison, went on to Camera Image's Instagram page and kind of admonished them for showing the film. Now, for those people who
have been
who
under
don't
a
know
rock.
The story already. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So Rust was the film where the DP was a woman named Helena Hutchins, and the armorer was, I would say, engaging in criminal mischief. I don't know if that's technically true, but
gross negligence.
She brought live ammo to the set of a Western and was putting it into the prop guns and I guess firing them. And so an actual bullet was in a gun that was handed to Alec Baldwin, who was told it was cold by all accounts. And he was just kind of aiming it and setting it up for the shot. And he killed the DP. And it was shocking and awful, and I'm of two minds because I think so Rachel Morrison is saying like it's okay to celebrate Helena's work as a cinematographer, it's not okay to promote the film that killed her. Fair enough. On the flip side, I feel like this is the best way to celebrate her work, and probably nothing would make any cinematographer happier than being prominently featured at Camera Image. You know, we never had her on the show, but she's exactly the kind of person we would have loved to have on the show.
Absolutely. And you know, it's not just Rachel Morrison. There's been quite a few people out there who have been posting the very mixed feelings and emotions about Camera Image doing this. There's quite a few people who say like, okay, great, glad that you're doing something and you're billing it this way as sort of like a tribute to Helena, but I'm not going. Either they're not going to the festival, or if they are going to the festival, they're not going to that screening. So it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's
I mean, I guess my opinion is if I had the wherewithal to go to Camera Image, I would totally go to it, and I would go to the screening, and I would go to the screening specifically to see her work. I mean, like, That to me is the most interesting thing about the movie. And although totally at random, a friend of mine who I think you know as well, but I'm not going to mention his name, he worked on the movie in post. He said it's really good. But every image I've seen from it, and you can find a few of them online, it looks gorgeous. It looks like a, you know, it's a Western, but it looks freaking gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know. Again, I'm of two minds, and, you know, far be it from me to argue with someone of Rachel Morrison's stature in the business. I just think, you know, the camera image screening, is that really promotion? I don't know. I mean,
if the way that the press release reads, which is easily defined out there if anyone wants to search it, it sounds a little sensationalistic because it's like the world premiere. It's the world premiere. And then it kind of pivots from the fact that it's the world premiere to there's like this tribute to Helena essentially going on there for this. And I hate to use like the, you know, the parlance of the younger generations, but it gives a lot of ick. There's a lot of bad feelings, I think, about this, and
a lot of ick and some cringe too.
It's just, man, it's dark. Yeah. It's dark. I don't know how.
But I mean, yeah. Like, okay, so
I don't know how they square that. I don't think they can. Yeah. And I think
so to use another example though, like, you know, if you've seen the original Crow,
yeah.
You know, like, I feel like they released that movie and it was in good taste to release the movie because it was a tribute to Brandon Lee's last film. That's your last chance to ever see Brandon Lee in a movie ever. Did he die because of gross negligence in the making of that movie? He did. You know, it wasn't something anyone wanted to have happen, but it happened. Do I feel guilty for having seen that, or should anyone feel bad for having released it or put it out there? It's like, it would be different in my opinion, and this is a terrible comparison to make, but it's like, it's hard for me to watch a Roman Polanski movie knowing what Roman Polanski is and what he has stood for.
Yeah. You have to separate, I think, the artist from the art sometimes. You know, it's interesting because,
well, but I'm saying that, like, nobody meant to do what happened.
Correct.
Here.
And no one meant for that to happen to Brandon Lee either. So
the armor on Rust, in my opinion, is the guiltiest of guilty parties. There are a few fail safes that all did not protect Helena Hutchins. And also it should be noted, the director who didn't die did also get shot.
He got shot at the same time. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's interesting because Alex Proyas, he directed The Crow, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. He went to movie jail for a while. I know movie jail is not the same as actual jail, but movie jail, it's like,
I mean, did he though? He had Dark City out like 2 years later.
Yeah, I think that Dark City was already like, it was already happening. It was already in the thing. No, it wasn't just 2 years. I think it was quite a bit after.
The Crow was 94, and I want to say Dark City was 96 or maybe 97.
No, 98 in your face, Ben.
Okay, so four whole years. Four years is not an unusual amount of time between anyone's movies.
But you know what? The movie was a much lower budget, and it didn't get a lot of attention. And I would say that, like, you know, it's interesting because Alex Proyas was just in the news today too, as well, for criticizing Elon Musk. I don't know if you saw that. So
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. But look, if anyone deserved blame for that, it certainly wasn't him either, because that was totally not his purview at all on that movie. But absolutely, he was. You know, look, there was definitely a lot of talk about like whether or not he was going to get to keep working after that. So, and clearly he has.
And I mean, like,
iRobot, you know, he's done a bunch of other stuff too. So.
No, he's done a bunch, but I mean, you know, I don't think anyone blames the director of Rust. I think it's fair to blame the producers. I think it's mostly fair to blame the armor. And supposedly she was the daughter of like a legendary armorer who'd been doing it in the business for decades. And, you know, she just, there's no excuse, zero excuse for what she did. I mean, like, You should not, if a film set has a reason to have live actual bullets on the set,
there's not.
Then, yeah. But if you're making Mythbusters and you're doing something where you're testing something with real bullets, great. Have all the safety that you would have around that. Like, make it really obvious that that's what you're doing. And the fact that she was just like doing target practice or something between takes, I don't know why she did it, but it's just, to me, that has always been the disgusting thing on this. And I guess like where I land is that I want to celebrate Helena Hutchins' work, and this is the last thing we're ever going to see from her. And so I don't think if they wrote a bad press release, they wrote a bad press release. But I don't want to disappear the movie because it disappears her work. You know what I mean?
It's fair points for sure. All right. Well, Ben, I think we should get to the interview.
All right. Well, here is Eric Lin.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
So thank you so much for coming on the show, Eric. Watched House of Spoils. Really, really cool, really fresh, unique idea. A fresh idea. Tell me, like, before we even get going, like, what's the pitch of House of Spoils?
So House of Spoils follows a chef, named Chef in the film, played by Ariana DeBose, who basically quits her sort of Michelin star kitchen job to start her own restaurant upstate, sort of a farm to table restaurant in a state upstate, with a restaurateur played by Ariane Moyad. And unbeknownst to her, this estate has sort of a history, a prior owner who still has a presence on the state and starts to influence the goings-ons as she tries to battle to open this restaurant. And yeah, it's sort of a supernatural, witchy story that, says a lot about being a leader, being an artist, creating, respecting nature. So it involves it's kind of a rich stew of themes, if you will.
And what brought you to the project?
Let's see, it came through my agent, but I think I sort of hope, I never asked the producers, they actually produced a feature called Resurrection, which is directed by Andrew Siemens, and I shot Andrew's first feature called Nancy Please way back in the day. That was like 2017 or 2018 or something like that. So there's some sort of connection. I never actually asked them how they sort of came to me. And I should. I guess I'm too shy to. But yeah. So it came through the agent, and I just met on it. I loved it. I read the script, and the vibes were on the paper, the kind of the strange tones. And when I met with the directors, they had so many great just like references that were very sort of unconventional, like out of the box, and it was like super inspiring. So I wanted to be part of it.
So what kind of out of the box references? Like what were some of the kind of cool, surprising things they brought to you?
A lot of them were like surrealist paintings. There's one they reference a lot, Leonor Fini, and it's like, there's this one painting I'm thinking about. It's like a red sunset, half a woman and like submerged in a lake. There's like dead fish heads around her. It's this thing that's very much about like body, nature, and sort of nightmarish visions of, the two of those things. There was other references, Adrian Van Utrecht, who did these sort of like still lifes, it'd be like a rose on a table, but then there'd be a skull there, uh-huh. And it was sort of all, it had this patina too of like rot and, decay that was like really great. And I took that a lot of that inspiration from their initial, references, when thinking about the look of the film.
Now, when you go to a meeting with directors where, basically it's like you've been recommended for the film, but you don't have a pre-existing relationship with the director or directors in this case, what do you prepare? I mean, obviously, you're familiar with the script. Do you put together a lookbook? Do you wait to hear what they're looking for? Like, how do you pitch yourself when you're going to meet with directors who you don't already know?
Oh man, this is sort of the eternal question for me. I'm still trying to figure out how to interview for films. I don't think it's like my career long quest. I try to be pretty flexible. I like preparation, so I will often pull images for myself. Whether or not I use them in the meeting is something that sort of a game time decision. Because sometimes I'll pull stuff and their vision will be something completely different, and then we'll need and obviously it's not relevant. I'm always trying to figure out like how the right way to approach it, but it's always, even when I'm reading, and I know a lot of people say they read the script like the first time to get the story, and then the second time they sort of dive in, but as I'm reading, I'm always pulling references and jotting down ideas, and like anytime like something sort of occurs to me as I read a screen description or a location or something like that, or if it makes me think of a photo or a painting. I'll pull that into a folder, and so I'll compile this sort of lookbook. But I don't like, me personally, I don't like meetings that where I'm like giving a presentation of what I think the film should be. You know, I think in the meeting, I'm trying to figure out, can we collaborate? You know, like, and then I often, you know, this is something I figured out maybe too late in my career, but I tried to choose.
It's still pretty early in your career. I think you're okay.
Thanks. I choose like a few scenes, like two or so often three scenes that I don't know the answer to. I'm like, how would we shoot this? Or what's your idea for this? And is that something we can collaborate on the call? Because like basically, I feel like the interview is sort of that, is like, can we collaborate together on this creative issue that, you know, isn't totally clear to me? Or do you have a clear vision of it? And what is that vision? So sometimes it's like having the right questions, I think, for myself, to know what I want to get out of the meeting and understand like what their vision is. And yeah, again, that key thing is like whether or not we can collaborate. And it doesn't mean that we will necessarily agree on the vision, but it's like, if you're throwing out an idea and like I say something that maybe is off the wall, but you know, maybe it's something comes out of that, like, you know, that collision of ideas. So that's always exciting to me. And that's when I feel like, even if I don't get the job, like I realize I felt like I, you know, got the sense of who this person was as an artist and creative, and yeah, what they would be like as a collaborator.
I think, you know, like what you're saying there is something that I've come to very late in life, which is if I have a meeting with somebody and it doesn't matter who it is or how big they are, like, I think that I used to have performance anxiety about it, and like I wanted to come off good, and I wanted them to have a good impression of me. And the older I've gotten, the more it's like, it's either going to work out or it isn't, and it's so out of my hands whether it's going to work out. And the most important thing is just to have a good conversation. Like, if I can just have a good conversation and make a connection to that person, that's you know, that should be the only thing that happens in that meeting. Whether I get the job or not is an afterthought, which is hard to do, especially if you want the job. But
yeah. And I think, you know, also I've realized, you know, meetings too are also sort of the creative promise of yourself or who you are as an artist. You know, I've been trying to become more like that, because I think, you know, yeah, again, it's like that pressure to want the job if it's, you know, a script you really like or something. There's, you know, I think early on I used to like suppress like, oh, you know, whatever you said was great. But it's like, there's also things, obviously, I'm interested as an artist when I see a script and like want to push certain things and let them know like what those things are, because that's sort of, you know, my point of view as an artist, you know, and you want to make sure they have that sort of in front of them as a, you know, they're making their own decisions. Yeah. About like who you are.
So what were the things about the script for House of Spoils that like lit you up and got you excited about possibly shooting it?
So it was definitely the tone. I loved how sort of sly and witty it was, you know, and some of it's and a little bit subversive too, and it's storytelling. And I loved sort of the planting of like the eeriness and unsettlingness, you know, unsettled feeling of when the chef first gets to the house and all these things sort of go on. For me, there was this real battle of allegiance between her and the estate, you know, and the witch. And, you know, at a certain point, she sort of like goes along with it and fights against it. And tracking that was like super interesting to me, and how like, you know, the world of the how the house sort of represented this witch and the things she did. And, you know, you're trying to figure out what the agenda is or what the point is. Is it just a haunting? Like what is behind it? And you start to learn the story behind it. So for me, all of that was like super, super like inspiring and interesting, you know, and wanting to really dive into that sort of like eerie tonality of being inside, like, sorry, I would go on a tangent. Like, whenever me and my wife used to go upstate to houses, you know, we always hated houses that had like woods up to the windows, because you couldn't see beyond the windows, right? You'd like, you don't know what's out there. And there's like real eeriness about being inside a house in the middle of nowhere and not being able to see what's out there. And, you know, bringing that feeling into a film, I thought was like super, super interesting.
Cool. And I don't know if there were filmic references, but when I was watching it, I mean, even like at the very beginning, I immediately started getting vibes of Lucio Fulci's The Beyond, you know, which takes place in New Orleans. But it's like old falling down, not falling down, but like old estates and people going into these houses. Were there any movies that, you know, and you know, your film is kind of a horror movie. It's not like a horror. It's not. It's got a lot of good scares and good jumps in it, but it's more, I'd say probably more of a character piece, but that pulls you through it. But were there specific references or films that you saw as related or similar in any way?
Yeah. I feel like the film is so much of it is psychological. So we looked a lot at Black Swan, kind of like a sort of a ruthless subjectivity and like the hallucinations and how terrifying those things are.
And I feel like that movie is referencing the kind of movies it's referencing, like the old Italian giallo movies a lot. So,
yeah, exactly. So it's like sort of flipping it. We owe so much to The Shining, so it's hard to not talk about it, especially like single location film.
Yeah.
And wanting the personality of the house to sort of reflect sort of the terror of what's going on. But those were two that really came out. And then there were other sort of like Phantom Thread, but that was more about like artist's obsession and, you know, detail and craft and rigor. And I mean, a couple other sort of random ones was like Let the Right One In.
Love it. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the,
it's probably my top five horror movies of all time. Like, I love that movie.
Such a great film. And the thought behind the filmmaking is so incredible. You know, like the pool scene for me, I always talk about that pool scene at the end.
Brilliant.
Where he's being held underwater and all this stuff is happening behind him and just, you know, sound, and you see little
the whole
bits
story
of, like,
being told
pieces.
in one frame where you don't get the whole, where you don't see it. It's just, you're seeing, God, that movie.
More terrifying. Yeah, it's so great.
It's the best.
Yeah, and so it's a super, for me, it's like super powerful and way to represent that moment. And so it's always influential to me because it's also very, ruthless in how you present this experience. But it's so subjective that I feel like people are just completely invested in, you know, seeing it rather than cutting to like random vampire, you know, girl tearing apart people or boys. That was one that I always thought about. And, you know, it sort of came about in the friends and family dinner when Andreas's aunt has a shellfish allergy, and he runs into the kitchen and tries to go for the EpiPen and then runs back outside. And I remember like our initial conversations about it, I was like, oh shit, you know, it's a lot of activity, right? It's like Andreas has got to run out, he's got to grab the EpiPen. They're like he's dealing with the aunt and all the other relatives are there, and then Chef comes in, and then Chef has to react to that. Do we need, you know, different sides of this, and how to, you know, what the feeling is, and like, is it frantic? Like, are we handheld? And so it became really messy. And then we started thinking about Let the Right One In. It's like, well, what if it's just all from Chef, right? And so we just do this long zoom in. She runs in. You know, we sort of zoom in the wide shot, in the wide part of the frame. We see Andreas in the foreground, start to get everything ready. We hear him, you know, everybody's sort of screaming. But we just sort of do this very long zoom in just on her face as she reacts to it. And then she faints because she had, you know, lost blood from the scene prior. But instead of a shot that became about like scattering, you know, getting all the information, it was like, oh, just focus on the one emotional moment, which is really Chef realizing that she totally, you know, dropped the ball and you know, truly messed up. Yeah. And might cost her the restaurant.
No, that's interesting. Well, and you bring up something too that, like, you know, sometimes when I'm watching a movie, like the movie reveals its rules to me, and I don't know if I decoded you correctly or not. But like, I think about like Children of Men, when you're watching Children of Men, when you realize they haven't cut for a minute, you know, something horrible is about to happen and it's going to be a long sequence. And with this film, I noticed that, whenever the camera started zooming, like the zoom preceded something, some kind of revelation or some kind of, not a jump scare necessarily, but the zoom was kind of portending like we're moving into her emotional space or something. How intentional was that?
Yeah, it was really intentional. It's weird because zooms are so, you know, it's not a natural way of seeing, but I personally find zooms so psychological. You know, there's something about just like your attention and like the world compressing and how you sort of like, you know, especially in like that moment, how every other part of the world sort of, you know, disappears or gets pulled away from you. So for me, yeah, zooms are super psychological, and we tried to find ways that we sort of would sneak them in because it has this very unsettling feel because it's so sort of omniscient and so like unnatural the way it sees. But I find that
and Kubrick-ish to kind of go back to your Shining thing.
Like, yeah, Yeah, exactly.
Such a Kubrick move, like to kind of go. Well, I'm blanking on who it was who said it, so I don't want to misspeak and say who it was who said it. But we had a guest on here once, and she said that when you dolly, you're bringing the camera closer to the subject. When you zoom, you're bringing the subject closer to the audience. And I've always thought about that when I see stuff with zooms in it. I want to say it was Sybelle Martin, but I could be wrong. But it just really stuck with me because it's like, yeah, like, you know, even like a movie like The Usual Suspects, which cross cuts, zooms, and dollies. I'm always what is it that obviously I'm like so in the weeds about this stuff, but like, what is it that the zoom is doing that's different than the dolly, but somehow the interaction of those two things say something different? And when you cross cut them, it's super weird because, you know, I think in the early days of Zoom, it's like, hey, we'll zoom instead of a dolly. And now it's no, Zoom is a very specific piece of language to use.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's super, I feel like it's like very, very psychological. When we first talked about the film, it wasn't like, oh, we should, you know, we're going to zoom all the time. You know, we're like, oh, we're going to, this should be a zoom. That should be a zoom. But we started looking at films and, Birth is one we also looked at. Like the opera scene. And, you know, it's like crazy, crazy long zoom over, I don't know, like 2 minutes, 3 minutes or something like that. And she's you see her husband sort of lean in and lean out of frame. But it's that thing that it's sort of like, I don't know, it's like visual editing, right? It's like you're sort of like pulling everything out of the world, like removing it until you're like left with this like close up of this face if it's a zoom in. And you know, I always think about that shot in Birth because it's, you know, you realize she's just thinking about what just happened. You know, she's in the middle of this opera and like her husband's like keeps leaning into frame and whispering at her, and there's like the opera going on, but she's, you know, even though she's staring straight ahead, she's super, you know, completely focused on the scene that happened prior with the boy. And so I just love how that the zoom can give that effect of like, because if you had just cut to a close-up, you don't have that feeling of like understanding that, you know, she's completely lost in this world. So
yeah, it's weird. It kind of just almost puts you into like the headspace of a person who's like tuning out the world and just thinking. I mean, maybe that's what the Kubrick effect of it is, you know, when you think about like the zoom in on Jack Nicholson in The Shining, like why is that a zoom? You know, like why not a dolly? Why not a static shot? Why specifically a zoom? And anyway, I love the way that you employed them.
Thank you.
Also, like there's a sense of lighting, and whenever I'm watching a movie where there's lots of, or a TV show, you know, if you're watching The Bear or The Menu or something like that, which to me are like obvious references that at least were floating around in my head. You know, it's like, well, you also have to do amazing food photography. And then in the case of this movie, you also have to occasionally do horrifying food photography that still looks like it's in the same world. Can you talk a little bit about like how you approached the food and, you know, like the way you lit it, the way you lensed it, like how were you overall thinking about it? And also like, how are you, you know, like if you're doing a food commercial and you're just getting close-ups of hamburgers or something, that's one thing. But like when you have to make it fit into the overall film, so it has to fit into the overall patina of the film that you're creating, like how much of it was making something where the food would look a certain way and the movie around it looked like the movie that was in, or making the food look like it was in the movie that you were otherwise shooting?
So we sort of tried to do the latter as best we could. So sort of going back, actually, this will be about Lutz. When we, you know, I took a lot of inspiration from Bridget and Crudy's initial references, and the one I mentioned, like Van Utrecht's still life with the skull, you know, there's this brownness to everything. Like the skull is like sort of, there's like sort of an off-white. There's sort of a, it's sort of in a, I don't know what the background is. It might be a wall or something, but it's very brown. And then the blacks aren't inky. They're sort of like a polluted black. And so the film, for me, I was super interested in trying to find a way to represent the colors that we had this feeling of like decay. And like almost like a mushroom mold vibe, you know, because what comes from that too, that decay is life, right? It's like creativity, and it's born through all this sort of like death and decay. And so I wanted really like the colors of the film to represent that feeling, right, of like rot and decay. And and sort of the life that can come from it. And so we did a bunch of tests, and we had to really create, you know, we sort of bent the browns, we bent the greens so they weren't as verdant, you know, yellow, they are all sort of like this, this mustardy color, mushroomy color. But then, you know, with the colorists, we basically found a way that certain bright colors, like in the test, I would ask the food people, our food stylist, Zoe Hedges, who's amazing. I would say, give me the brightest colors you'll use in the dishes, like, you know, reds, oranges, pinks. And we were able to pull out of the LUT these like more extreme colors so that they lived and looked correct, right? Yeah. So every other color that's sort of in like the tertiary color got sort of bent into these like brownish world, this mushroomy vibe. But wanted to make sure that these sort of vibrant colors sang, you know, and didn't get pulled into like the muck of like the rest of the film. And so, you know, she gave us a bunch of like different color, yeah, like bright yellow saffron, you know, like bright pinks, reds, you know, from tomatoes and stuff like that. And so in the LUT, we were able to sort of dial the frequency so that these more extreme colors could sort of sing. And we had to keep that out of the rest of the film though, right? We had to really isolate and make sure that the food, you know, it was the only place that got sort of those really vibrant
so that like colors. That ripples into like wardrobe and production design and all that too.
Yeah, exactly. So, and we did, this is a film maybe I did more testing than any other film, and it was really great because we could really bring in all these departments, because like food was doing its own thing, production design was basically transforming this house and making sure all the colors sort of made sense, especially within this LUT and this world that we were trying to create and make it sort of unified. So that was just sort of in terms of color. And then in terms of the food photography, you know, we, man, there's a lot to talk about. We had an amazing AD, Rachel Jensen, who, you know, had to organize sort of rehearsals. We had to know in prep exactly what the dish would look like and what the components of the dish would be, because we would design all of the blocking and cooking around it. Right, because the kitchen was essentially live, and a lot of them were doing handheld shots where we're sort of floating between stations. So it wasn't like we could just have an extra in the background just cutting onions. Like they had to like deliver that onion to the person who's about to put it in the pan, who's about to like fire this sauce, who's about to drop it on the station. So it actually had to be like choreographed, almost like a dance. You know, like we had to really understand who would be at what station, doing what ingredients, bring it over to where. We had to pre-visualize these dishes like very, very early on in prep to even understand what we were shooting. And so that featured into the blocking, like especially the opening scene. It's actually much shorter than what we shot, but we had this whole extended sequence of seeing that entire dish created from, you know, from all the different stations and how it all sort of comes together. And so even in the kitchen at the estate, you know, similarly, we had to understand that. And, you know, when she finds like those ingredients from the woods, we wanted that again, you know, because of the LUT, we really wanted to sing, you know, if it's like this green that's like super vibrant, you know, it had to be sort of this kind of green that we could really push through the LUT. And then same with like the tomatoes or stuff she found. And so while we were shooting, we basically, especially like the living room when they're serving the dinner to Andreas, you know, I sort of lit the room how I thought the room should be. And we always knew we would do these like sort of special shots on the dishes themselves. And so second unit would actually handle that. And so we would shoot the scene, establish the lighting, and then because there was sort of a series of dishes being presented to the table. And, you know, that took time obviously because Zoe, the food stylist, had to like perfect each dish. Like she would have them for the scene, but when we were putting them on camera and close up, obviously wanted to be pristine. And so she had a whole station.
And you have to like do it immediately too. You can't wait an hour. Yeah. You have to do it like,
exactly
when it's ready. Still, I've totally shot food. Yeah. It's like you can tell on camera if it's old.
Yeah. It's gotta be like right away, and everything's gotta be ready. And that whole montage is like very static, so it could be repeated, but we had to make sure that, you know, it was a dedicated camera for that. And so I think all we did was really accent it with another like spotlight to just, you know, cut through sort of the warmth. Cause I think in that living room, we went sort of for like a really pretty heavy warmth, and wanting to make sure that the whites of like, I forget which dish that is. It's like, a smoked trout dish or something, had, you know, like a white cream color, and we wanted to make sure that white came through. So we, you know, we would pop something just sort of soft right onto the dish itself. like a Leica to pop, make it pop and cleaner colors.
Interesting. We've had a few people on here, I think, who've worked with more than one director, but it's a little uncommon. I don't know what the process was, because I think that every time there's a directing team, they split or don't split the work differently. But how was it working with two directors for you?
It was great. They're a dynamic duo. Bridget and Crudy are amazing. And I almost call them like they're like force multipliers for each other. And they're a pair who it's not like they split duties. They both weigh in on everything, and they both have, and they both come from camera. You know, like Bridget used to shoot like music videos and like docs in New York, and Crudy was assistant to Maddie Leibetick for a while, like Black Swan actually. Yeah.
Oh wow.
So they come from camera department. So
did you talk to him at all? Did you tell him you were referencing his movie?
No, I didn't. I'll bring it up though next time I see him. But they're super visual, and they understand the visual language and know how to talk about it. And, you know, sometimes there's directors that you work with who have a hard time visualizing what you're describing, especially in prep when you're just creating shot lists, or it can be a little abstract. But they immediately understood kind of like, yeah, this, you know, this lensing, this effect, or this kind of camera movement, this effect. And so super, and they're super collaborative. I feel like they were like team captains of like their college sports or something. There's a real like coach mentality or coach vibe. Like they were really great about building a team and really affirming people and bringing people into conversation. So I thought it was great. You know, I'm sure like every director is different. Every directing duo, I'm sure, is like very different. But they're almost like sisters, because I think they've been collaborating for so long, and they wrote the script together, and like they did their first film together, Blow the Man Down. So they have a long history of understanding each other. But I think what was great, especially, is like they're always interrogating the idea, like best idea wins. So it was never pressure. Neither of them, they were very respectful of each other and everybody else's opinions. And so there was never like sort of a bad idea. It's like it was never a push and pull. It was always like, what is, yeah, literally the best idea. And luckily we had, you know, we had about 8 weeks of prep, and we had to lock the location way ahead of time, because that determined everything, right?
You could do 20 different locations and have 20 different movies here.
And I think they ended up doing a lot of rewriting because of, you know, obviously the demands of the location wasn't exactly what was in the script. What was great about that is in prep, we spent, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks doing the shot list on location, you know, because we had it there. It's like we're in the entrance, you know, like art department would be starting to paint stuff, but we'd be in other rooms, and we would, plot out, block out, take photo boards, talk about the blocking. And so it was a really amazing way to work. You know, we blocked out, I think, like half a day. Usually it's like half a day, sometimes up to a full day. It was sort of a location that was like an hour outside of Budapest, 45 minutes to an hour outside of Budapest. So we were able to, you know, do all that shot listing on set. And that was like an incredible time to have to again, interrogate these ideas. It's like we'd have a certain idea for blocking. Oh, it doesn't totally make sense. Or maybe this thing is a little bit awkward. Or it means, you know, like we figured out sort of the geography of that kitchen layout, because Alexandra Schaller, our production designer, built that kitchen, you know, from scratch. So we had to understand who would be moving where, like where's the walk-in closet, or where's the stove, where's all that stuff. And so we would, you know, constantly be sort of revisiting these scenes and reworking them over and over again with different ideas. It's like, well, we put this sink here, that means like her back will be turned when this happens. And, you know, we had to constantly revisit, because so much happens in that kitchen. You know, we needed a lot of time to really understand what it would be.
Well, that's something that I kept thinking about too, is like when you're shooting a lot of scenes in one location, there is a temptation that certain producers who will remain nameless that I've worked with have enforced, which is like, what if we block shoot all this? What if we just, you know, shoot all this angle and then shoot all this angle for every scene? Was there any discussion of doing that? And the flip of that too is like, how do you keep the same, like what is the arc of the kitchen? Because so much happens in there. Like, how are you visually showing, like if you took a scene from, you know, minute 75 versus minute 25, how would it be different color-wise, composition-wise, lensing-wise? What, how would you film it differently? Because you have day scenes in there, you have night scenes in there.
Yeah, we took it sort of sequence by sequence. I mean, there's sort of the, you know, when you're first in there, there's sort of the initial blush, which is like, you know, rotten sandwiches, rotten fruit everywhere, decay, you know, lights are out, lights only coming through the window. You know, you use a lot of hay, so you feel like very dusty, abandoned, you know, place that hasn't been set in foot, you know, no one's set foot in there for a long time. And then she sort of cleans it up. And so she makes it functional. So the space sort of takes that sort of change. And, you know, we put in sort of a softbox above the main part of the kitchen. You know, we installed all that. So that kitchen essentially was a bedroom, a large bedroom, right? Because we needed a room. Yeah, we needed a room that could had easy access to outside. And the actual kitchen at that estate was like sort of a tiny, you know, barely functional size kitchen. Like there's no way we could shoot all this stuff in that kitchen. So this idea was hatched to basically build the kitchen right there. And so it worked out perfectly because then she could look out, see the garden. She could, you know, and she had constantly had to go in and out of the kitchen to the backyard. So that was like the one room that had like really easy access to the outside without having to go all the way through the whole house. You know, once we installed that kitchen, and so like we installed all the lighting, you know, I understood like we could put in, you know, we knew certain stations, so we built lighting into the place. And, you know, I tried to, because it's about nature, you know, I think the, when we feel the sun became super important, right? Like when it's like sort of a inspiration or when it's, she's feeling some sort of like creative force, you know, I wanted like to feel the sun more. And then if she wasn't, then sometimes I would play more with mixed lighting. You know, it'd be like tungsten, but it'd be overcast day, blue light coming in, and it would, you know, they would sort of like fight against each other, and then you'd have practicals that were a different color temperature. So there'd be sort of like fractured lighting. So it became pretty thematic in terms of how, you know, how you would employ kind of the balance, especially with sunlight, tungsten lighting, and how far we go with each. And then in terms of like how we treated the space, you know, Sing Street is sort of a film I think about too when it comes to creativity. And so like when Lucia and Chef are, you know, coming up with the menu, you know, when they sort of, when the after Chef discovers like the garden, you know, it had to be very like floaty, freeing, you know, it had to flow through it.
Yeah.
When she first cooks before that, she's sort of doing, sort of, you know, I guess in the film, what they call sort of like the greatest hits of, you know, fine dining. That was much more like rigid, right? It's much more static. It was on
when
on
she has sticks. Like, it was on. She doesn't have all the right ingredients that she wanted, so she has to kind of make do, and she just does a really good job with what she's got.
Yeah. Well, so actually it's before that. Sorry, I'm talking out of order. The first dinner she cooks for Andreas and Tolly, it's when she's trying to put the pea on top of that one dish, and then you know, she's like, oh, it's like, you know, she's doing sort of like what she thinks like fine dining should
like,
be.
Yeah, like a she's got like a tweezer that she's using.
Yeah, the tweezer's out. So that was like super rigid, you know, it was on sticks, it was very like formal, it was very like stuck in a way. But when she starts to find like these ingredients in the garden, then it loosens it up, and the camera itself starts to fly, you know, starts to become more free and more kinetic. And so we tried to juxtapose those two things. And even when she serves the dinner, you know, once you're, it's sort of like back of house, front of house, you know, once you're out there, it's all formal presentation, but in the back of the house, it's like freeing creativity and looseness. And that's what I think about. That's why I sort of referenced Sing Street, is it has this sort of like feeling of like jazz or improvisation, you know, that we wanted, and tempo. And so it really took us sequence by sequence how we sort of like treated the kitchen stuff, but it was a lot. I mean, it's like, you know, yeah, when we looked at the page count, we were in that kitchen so much.
I mean, you wouldn't happen to remember that page count. Like I'm just curious if it's like,
I'll 20, have to look it up.
25 or 30 pages of that movie could be in the kitchen. I wouldn't be.
Yeah.
That seems like a lot though, but yeah.
Yeah. I'll have to dig it up because I remember like we would. Rachel, the AD, was good about that because like we left the kitchen every once in a while, which is good. We didn't just like stay there for all the kitchen stuff. It would have just been nightmarish. But Yeah, the stuff that we did have to block shoot was, I guess it wasn't quite block shooting, but it was actually the garden. So the both gardens were totally created, you know, by Alexandra, our production designer, and her greens department. So because they both get trashed at different points.
Yeah, right?
I guess the first one gets trashed very early on. The second one, when she discovers at night, you know, gets trashed. And so we had to, you know, obviously we have to shoot everything up before it and then have her trash it. And that became tricky too, because we had to, like, we were shooting from October to November, and in Budapest at that time, man, I mean, like, I have this photo of a tree that was right outside the house. And when we first started shooting, normal tree, by the time we ended shooting, it was naked. Like, all the leaves had fallen. So we had to become super aware. We had to, you know, when we have night scenes, we had to make sure, you know, we were there, we were shooting all this stuff while there were still leaves on the tree, because it happened pretty quickly. But we were shooting, yeah, we shot like 35 days. So by the time we started to when we ended, it was right around the time when things would start changing and falling and leaves would fall. So we had to be like super, you know, aware of all that stuff. And so like the garden sort of dictated it. Even like, you know, like the bonfire when we shot that, because they had to like dig a fuel line for that sort of thing. So they would dig up the front yard. So we had to make sure we shot everything in the front yard before they would dig that up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's all these little things, because even though it's one location, like so much happens in the house that, you know, you really have to like do this three-dimensional chess to make sure you're getting the right pits at the right time. Yeah.
Well, cool. I mean, I feel like that kind of covers most of my questions about House of Spoils. Is there anything else that like you would, you know, any big struggles, success stories, any overcoming of adversity that you would like to highlight in the film before we move on?
Coming of adversity.
I don't know, weather, whatever, you know, all the things, you know, getting gear up a hill, digging a hole, the tunnel underneath. I mean, I assume that was a set, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. The, what would I say? Fog became this thing. It was funny. Like when I tried to sort of use haze and atmosphere whenever there was something mystical going on. So like when she finds the garden, even if it's in the daytime, we'd have like, you know, a little bit of haze going on. But by the time we wrapped shooting, like just by the geography of where this house sat, there was like nonstop fog at night, like always. And in the morning when we got there.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's funny. It just sort of like became what the film wanted to be. Yeah. So like all those firelight scenes at the end, the scenes at the end that take place around the bonfire and when they're cooking outside, yeah, like wide shots, if you see it, it's all, you know, super hazy and foggy, and it added so much, and it's just pure luck of the draw, you know. It wasn't like, yeah, I mean, we would have wanted it, but yeah, we were lucky to get it. So that was a huge win for us. Yeah, what else was there? You know, moonlight was a huge thing, like wanting to feel like hard direct moonlight, you know, not mm-hmm. like and that was like something that we talked about a lot in prep, but like the execution of it became a little tricky, just in terms of like, because it was this sort of estate, it was sort of like a vast, you know, it was a vast estate, and we were lucky because there was a lot of trees that could hide where we could put condors and stuff, but kind of where they could get to became a little bit hard, and they sort of you know, they would sit there for like a month essentially, so we had to like, we couldn't really move it at a certain point, but had an amazing gaffer, Jolt, who it's sort of old school, and like we shot on the Venice, and we shot like 2500 ISO, and you know, I'd be like, when we tested the moonlight LUT, it was like, man, I only need 2 foot candles, you know, for moonlight, because we're underexposing at like 3 stops, so it's like barely any light. He's like, and he would like turn the sky. We had these sky panels on condors, and we turn it way way down, and I'd be like, oh, it's, you know, I need like 5 less foot candles. He's like, Eric, is that 1%? Like, I can't, he's like, I can't turn it anymore. So we'd have to like pan this like light away to get the coverage. But it became this dance of like condors essentially to try to get the moonlight in the right place. But we, you know, we love that feeling. And you know, I think maybe one of the more challenging scenes when it came to Moonlight when she's in the woods, right? Because it's like so much tree cover. Like we couldn't just blast a light through the trees to sort of get moonlight on her because it just soaked it all up. It was just like too dense, and we could never get the light in the right place to get into this path where she's like walking up to the garden. So we had to do this thing where we were like hanging lights from trees. You know, like we had this path that we wanted her to go through, and it was, I don't know, maybe like, maybe 50 feet or something like that, maybe more, 60 feet. But we had to just like hide all these lights into the trees to make it like feel like moon, like one continuous moonlight source. And that was like a little bit nutty, because we're like in the middle of the woods trying to do this.
So let's talk a little bit about just kind of your background, where you came from. I always want to know what was the moment in your life where you realized being a cinematographer was a job you could pursue, and what made you kind of go down that road?
Ooh, it's a good question. You know, I came up doing photography in high school. I was like the photo editor of the yearbook. And I, you know, in our social studies class, we got to make like, you know, videos, like lame little videos or whatever, explaining this or that. And I realized how much I loved that. And, you know, my dad is a scientist, and I always thought I would go into science. But I was always captivated by, you know, trying to figure out, I mean, I think, you know, something we talked about before we started the show was about, reading American Cinematographer, figuring out how did people shoot this, you know, and maybe the science part of my brain really gravitated towards that. I was like, understanding like, well, like, you know, that the shot in Robin Hood where the camera's attached to the arrow and it flies, you know, through the forest and like, how do they do that? How do they rig that? It's amazing. You see the behind the scenes shots, and it was like such a fascinating process, like sort of the magic, the magic trick of it, you know, like all the mechanics they had to do to get that one effect, became super fascinating to me. So in Berkeley, you know, I went to UC Berkeley, and I sort of made a hard decision. Like I don't want to do science. And my dad was like very supportive, because he understood that he was successful because he was very passionate about it. He's like, if you're passionate about what you do, and it'll, you know, sort of withstand all the doubts, then
what kind of science does he do, out of curiosity?
So he's a biochemist.
So you're at Berkeley, and you're finding, I mean, like, does Berkeley have a film program? I should know this, and I don't.
So they don't. They have a great film criticism program. So we thought a lot about film, but they do not have a film production program. And so I felt like I was lucky, because in the Bay Area, there's a lot of documentary filmmakers, and they were willing to take me on as an intern and teach me, you know, Avid and how to shoot and stuff like that. I would follow around shoots. I ended up coming to New York for NYU. After Berkeley, I was like, oh man, I want to commit to this. I want to go all in. And I came straight to NYU for the film program here. Yeah.
Awesome. And so, you know, again, I see kind of, there's any number of paths, as many people as we've talked to, there's that many paths, but there's kind of, they kind of fall into two categories. One is people who want to work their way up through lighting and camera and eventually get to be a DP, and some people, and the others who want to start by being a DP. So they DP lower budget stuff, and then the budgets creep up. And obviously there are people who do some combination of both, like they're working in the camera department on big stuff and then DPing music videos on the weekend. But like, how did you go about kind of feeding the passion after you got out of NYU?
Yeah. So at NYU, you know, what's great is you're shooting all your classmates' films. If you end up wanting to like DP a lot, you end up shooting your classmates' films. And like, I just started taking on, you know, other people's projects and loved like the collaborative nature of DPing. And so after school, it's like the easiest way for me to make money was actually in editing. Like I had learned Avid before I went to NYU, and after NYU, we were the first, man, I'm going to really date myself. We were the first class we were the guinea pig class for NYU to decide whether or not they're going to use Final Cut Pro, right? They're like, we don't know. New program, like time code, we don't know how it works with like matching back to film. We still shot on film. How do we conform it, you know, because it's not Avid. So out of NYU, a lot of these like commercial houses, there's one I worked for called Curious Pictures, they did a lot of animation graphics for commercials and animation for television shows, animated television shows. And I was like an assistant editor. So it was like, you know, because like Final Cut was sort of new, all the graphics people liked it, but the editor still used Avid. So I would like take the animated graphic file, lay it onto a timeline, lay it out to tape, give it to the Avid editor so he could load it into his Avid to digitize it off the tape. Yeah. I was like the step in between from these guys to that guy. It didn't last very long, but that was like one of my first jobs after school. But it became a great way to, you know, make money and live. But in the meantime, I was just like taking any shooting job I could, you know. And I had always DP'd, and you know, as things got on, I started falling in love with camera operating for other DPs, because then I could see how they work. You know, it was, you know, DPing is one of those things where if you don't come up through crew, you never have a chance to understand how other DPs work and how they interact with directors. So any chance there was for me to DP for, or to camera operate for my my friends who were DPs, I would jump at it to learn from them. But meanwhile, yeah, I was just trying to shoot as much as I could and shoot whatever I could. So the director that I met in the Bay Area, Kit Hui, I had done a couple of her shorts. She ended up going to Columbia. I did her second year, her thesis film called Missing, and it ended up getting into Cannes official competition.
Oh, wow. That's a big deal.
And it was,
That's a big deal. There's not that many films getting into Cannes. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was bonkers to us. I mean, we were kids then. But it was incredible, and it was an incredible experience. So then I did her first feature after that. She started getting into like Cannes residency, Sundance Labs. But that's how I got my first feature. Yeah. And then, you know, because she went to Sundance Lab, they put me in touch with like Bradley Rusgrave was doing his feature, Exploding Girl, and a lot of his DP had to pull out last second. So then Kit recommended me, and then I started shooting all these sort of mumblecore pictures, and making no money for a long time, but supporting myself by editing. You know,
well, what's interesting to hear your story though too is that like one of the things that I always think about, a good DP will tell you, and not every DP does a lot of editing, but a DP knows if two shots will cut together, if there will be any problems cutting them. And the fact that you've done so much editing probably has that just in your bones, like you're probably incapable of shooting something that won't edit. Like you probably, I'm assuming when you're filming, you know how the sequence goes together.
Yeah, it is true how much you have to talk about editing as a DP, you know, because when you're creating a shot, you know, sometimes, when you work with people who don't necessarily understand like why these two shots won't edit, you have to really let them, you know, you have to explain it to them. It's like, well, we can, you know, it's why you're not going to spend the time to do it, or, you know, it'd be a waste of time to do it because it'd be a jump cut, or, you know, you need to cut to this angle instead and bring it into here. But you have to understand how like a sequence will play out. Absolutely. To, you know, because it's narrative storytelling, right? It's like, it's not just the image. It's not just, the image doesn't stand on itself. You know, you have to understand what's flowing in and out of it and how it's all pieced together.
Yeah, so by the time this episode drops, people will be able to check out House of Spoils on Amazon Prime. Please check it out. It looks great. It's a really fun movie. Perfect month to be watching it. It's coming out in October, so it's perfect for spooky season, as we like to say. Any place you'd like to direct people online to see your work or interact with you or whatever you want?
Yeah, sure. I'm on Instagram a lot. My handle's Hold the Frame, all one word. And then my website is eric-lin.com.
And that's L-I-N. So
L-I-N. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. We appreciate it. I hope House of Spoils, I don't know how Amazon checks the analytics, but congratulations on it. And I hope it does whatever Amazon wants it to do.
Thanks for having me. And thanks for speaking with me about it. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, so that was Eric Lin. Everybody go check out House of Spoils. It's really good, really scary. It looks amazing. Eric's work is freaking gorgeous in it, and can't wait to have him back on the show.
And now, Short Ends.
All right, so Ben, it's the short end time of the show. It's when we talk about our pet obsessions. Are you about some sort of movie, television, software? What are you about this week?
I went down a rabbit hole on Tubi, and this isn't like cutting edge new stuff, but I saw on Tubi, as you will on Tubi, I saw a movie that I've talked about, I've heard about, I know what it's about, but I'd never seen it. And it was Strangers on a Train, the Alfred Hitchcock movie from 1951.
Wow, yeah.
And I had never seen it. And, you know, I knew what it was about, and I knew kind of the basic pitch, which, if you don't know what it's about a like a tennis pro who's kind of publicly having a problem with his marriage, and he meets a guy on a train, and the guy on the train basically is complaining about his dad, and basically is like, hey, I have an idea. I can take care of your problem. You take care of my problem. And then he goes off and kills the tennis pro's wife, and it was like, pay up, time for you to murder for me. And the tennis pro guy, who is trying to get into politics and is a very clean-cut person, is like, what are you talking about, you psychopath? And it's honestly, yeah. This movie is freaking great.
Wow.
And right. it looks amazing. It might be my favorite Hitchcock movie.
Oh, wow. I've never seen it.
Yeah, I mean, like, take a couple hours. It is, you know, like, you know, when you think about movies from 1951, sometimes you think about, especially like Hitchcocky kind of things, there's like a certain staginess or formality, at least, to the way it's done, to the way it looks, whatever, you know, to the performance. Like, often the acting is kind of, and this movie is, for its time, extremely understated and naturalistic. Mm-hmm. And it's got a climax that I honestly didn't see it coming. I guess we've seen stuff like this, but you kind of look at it and go like, this is it takes place on a merry-go-round that's kind of lost control and is spinning out of control with kids on it, and it's a nail biter. And I looked it up too, and like, you know, the wide variety of techniques that they used, from like rear screen and front screen projection, and I believe miniatures, and all the stuff they did to kind of create it. Because I'm watching it, and again, like, when you're watching a movie that's, you know, at this point over 70 years old, you know, it's like, they probably had to do all that crap for real.
Yeah.
And no, they were using some pretty innovative rear techniques for its time. It was shot by a man named Robert Burks, who also shot Vertigo, you know.
Classic.
Well, he shot a bunch. He shot To Catch a Thief. He shot Rear Window. He shot Vertigo. And, you know, Vertigo, by some standards, according to some, is the greatest film of all time. It's really just a kick-ass movie. And if you've never seen Strangers on a Train, I can't encourage you strongly enough to go check it out for free. It's on Tubi. Check it out. It looks great. And apparently there's a European cut and an American cut. I don't know which one I saw, but apparently the European cut strays into risque for its time homoeroticism. Like, it implies some homoeroticism. And I will say that, like, it's a trope of its time that I feel like the bad guy in this is kind of gay coded. Like they, you know, like, they don't say anyone's gay in 1951. But he feels a little like Dr. Smith in Lost in Space. Like, there's something a little not, you know,
not heterosexual,
not heteronormative feeling about the guy. But, like, you know, again, like, they're just like so odd about it. But there's a scene in it that I love it when I see an older movie and it does this. And it's the scene where the bad guy kills the other guy's wife. And it's at like an amusement park at night. And there's a shot where her glasses fall on the ground, and we're seeing what's happening in the reflection of her glasses. Mm-hmm. And I'm watching it going, I don't know how they did it. Like, I just don't know.
They probably did it. They probably shot, you know, the reflection.
Well,
of the glasses.
I wonder if they got giant oversized glasses, or I don't know exactly how they did it, but it's like a really, it's just visually innovative. And, you know, no one ever, except for maybe Steven Spielberg, was better at just physical staging and blocking than Hitchcock. I mean, he kind of wrote the book on how to do that. And this movie's no exception. So I'll stop raving about it, but check it out. Strangers on a Train. I don't want to spoil it for you, but it did come out in 1951. So
yeah, I think that there's a good chance it's been spoiled for people already. Or if they just read the description on Tubi, it might do the same spoiling. I don't know.
It's a cool movie, though. It's I could see David Fincher making a movie just like it today.
Oh, nice. Yeah, cool. I don't know if it's ever been remade. I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I mean, I don't know. Remaking an Alfred Hitchcock movie is like remaking like a David Psycho. Lean movie or something. Yeah, exactly. Like, I think it's a little bit of a fool's errand.
Yeah.
But I think it's better to go like, ooh, what if you, I mean, you could go back because it's based on a book. You could go back and readapt the book and say, like, we're going to make Strangers, Bram Stoker's Strangers on a Train. We're going to go right back to the source. You know, you I guess you could do that, but also you could just appreciate the one that they made. Raymond Chandler was one of the writers on this.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's cool. Oh,
it's crazy, man. Olden times were interesting.
Definitely were.
But I suspect they smelled worse.
Most assuredly. Everything stunk more than back then.
I think the past must have really reeked. So, Ilya, what is your pet obsession of the week?
You know, after the Emmys came out and Blue-Eyed Samurai won an Emmy Award, I decided to give it a try. And you and I had talked a little bit how you said you'd never watched or never got into anime in any sort. Now, granted, this is not Japanese anime. This is anime from Canada, French-Canadian, I think, production for this thing. But
Canada-me?
I don't know if that's a term or not, but it's got a great voice cast. The you know, it's in English. There's no, like, you know, Japanese language version of it because it's made in Canada. But Randall Park, Kenneth Branagh, Masioka, if you remember Masioka from Heroes fame, and then of course George Takei. So really, really incredible.
Oh my!
Yeah, oh my is right. Yeah, it's a little salacious. It's a little adult. Okay, it's a lot adult. There's a lot of very graphic violence. There's a little bit of sex in it. And holy crap, it's really good. It's like, it's sort of Western sensibilities done in sort of a Japanese anime style. And I gotta say that, Ben, for someone who's never gotten into it or seen it, I think it'd be a really good entree for you. There's enough animated blood and gore that I think it would definitely hold your interest as well.
By the way, I mean, like, I've never gotten into, like, they're like random anime movies that show in theaters around here. And I feel like I feel illiterate. Like, I don't know about it, but I have seen, like, I read the comic book Akira was based on before the movie came out. I saw Akira. I've seen
Ghost
most
in
of
the
Miyazaki.
Shell. Yeah. Yeah. I know you've
yeah, talked. You know, I'm not completely without anime, but I think that there's a certain, when we think of anime, there's a certain kind of movie. And like, I don't think of maybe Miyazaki would disagree with me, but I don't think of Miyazaki as anime in the same way that I think
that what you were talking about before, though, specifically was sort of like the anime series style. That was never your thing.
Yeah.
I think this is a good entree for you. This is a good way.
I'll check it out. I'll definitely check it out.
It's on Netflix. I think it won one or two Emmys, and it's fantastic. It's actually really solid. It's a solid sort of like revenge thriller. I got to say, I think I liked it more than Kill Bill. So if you were a Kill Bill person,
what?
I know. So it's in the sort of a similar genre, and it's fun. And I got to say, I ended up binging, like, I think I binged like three or four episodes in one night. So it's pretty easy to get through them. It's it's a good show. You'd enjoy it, I think.
Cool. I will check it out.
All right. Well, Ben, I think that just about does it for this week. Who do we have to thank for making this show possible?
Oh my God! Well, we should thank Alana Cody first and foremost. Holy crap! I got to do an interview just a few days ago with someone I could not have possibly been more excited to talk to, and I can't wait to unleash this interview on the world. I'll leave the deep tease, but she's got. You and I are tag teaming it tomorrow. We're doing an interview first thing in the morning. We're kind of heading into award season, so we're going to be
busy.
We're going to be doing that, and I almost feel like we need to do the over under. Like every year, we try and get all five of the best cinematography nominees on here, and I think last year we got four of them.
Yeah, we did something like that. So we missed one, but we can try again this year.
yeah. So let's try again. We're dealing with the pandemic movies, so there are fewer of them. Or not pandemic, excuse me, the strike movies. Those are the ones that we're dealing with now.
Yeah.
So there aren't as many films that are going to be out there. So hopefully we can get all. Let's shoot for all five. I don't know, but that's on Alana, and I know she's doing her best. So we have to thank her. We got to thank Michael Dispenza, who hopefully cut my extremely tasteless joke out earlier.
But left this in so that people know that he cut out a tasteless joke.
It was, I crossed the line, people. I'm sorry, but it got cut out. You know, sometimes you say things and
you're apologizing like, for something no one has heard.
That's true. We should also thank Kay's Alatrachi, who composed every scrap of music that you've heard on this episode. Check out his website, musicbykays.com. Hire him to do any of the things he does, which is like everything. So if you're a filmmaker and there's a thing you need, my guess is Kays probably does some part of it and could hook you up.
Yeah, indeed. Hire Kays. Kays is super talented and totally worthy of your hire.
All right. So, Ilya, where can people find you if they want to find you online somewhere?
They can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com in Burbank, California, and in Portland, Oregon.
You're open.
I knew you were going to say that. By appointment. We are open by appointment.
All right. Are you getting a lot of appointments?
No. But I haven't. We don't even have a Google My Business page yet. We don't have anything yet. So everything's coming together. But, you know, we are.
But if you're in Portland and you want to check out some cool stuff.
Yeah, it'll be cooler come November 1. But right now it's a space, and I'm there, and I've got two chairs, so you know it's a thing. And we've got a machine running, and we're building stuff, which is cool. That's really what the space was for.
What kind of machine?
A CNC machine. It's about a $75,000 giant box that you put chunks of metal in it, and parts come out.
Parts of what are you making?
I'm making some lighting products in there, as a matter of fact. So yeah, I'm making some new stuff. So I spent the last 4 years developing something new, and I'm almost ready to tell the world about it, which I'm pretty excited about. I know.
If only you had a platform on which to do that.
You know, if only.
And you can find me, of course, at benrock.com. I'm not going to say all the shit I always say. Ilya, you want to take us out?
Thanks for tuning in.
All right.
You know what? It rolls off the tongue. It's good.
It does work. It's good. Yeah, no, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, not bad. I guess we got to thank Alana for one more thing.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.